Okay, I'm sharing the Bible reading today. We're just reading from Esther, chapter 3, verses 1 to 11. Haman's plot to destroy the Jews. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the Pur, that is the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all the other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I'll give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please."
Nasty bit of work. The story of Esther is unlike any other book in the Bible. It makes no mention of God. It makes no mention of the law, of the temple. It makes no mention of worship. It makes no mention of prayer. The closest thing that we find in the book of Esther to anything religious is a single reference to fasting. The book of Esther is also written differently. It sits alongside the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and Chronicles, but it is written much more dramatically. The book of Esther is written not just to inform, but also to, dare I say it, entertain. My dad can no longer read, he can't see. And a couple of weeks ago, Kathy and I were over at his place, and as is part of the rhythm, we will read scripture to him. And I said to him, "Would you like me to read the book of Esther to you, Dad?" Knowing that I'd be preaching on it in a few weeks' time. And he delightedly said yes. And as we read the story, and Kathy and I took it in turns, it was lovely to hear my dad, who couldn't read it, but who listened to the story. What did he do? He laughed. He laughed at the humor. There is humor in this book. He booed at Haman. He cheered when Haman got his own back. This is the way the book of Esther is meant to be read. It is history, but it is dramatized history. That's its genre. There are not many dramatized history books in our Bible, but this is it. And the humor in it is dark, so be careful if you read it to your children, thinking it's just a lovely, funny story. It is dark. Its humor is found in the mocking of its characters and in the irony of what unfolds. The story of Esther is how two descendants of Jewish exiles, Mordecai and Esther, they are cousins. This story is one of how they live faithfully as a minority people in a pagan empire. It is about faithfulness as a minority people in a pagan empire. And although God is not mentioned by name in this book, we see his presence in the coincidences that happen throughout the story. So this is the story. The story is set in Susa, is set 100 years after the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem and taken many Jews into exile. The Persian Empire now rules supreme, and their kingdom, their empire, stretches from India through to Ethiopia in today's country. It's a massive, massive empire. And the story begins with the king of Persia, Xerxes, and he's throwing a banquet for his nobles and officials to celebrate his own greatness. He's been in reign for around about 3 years, and he's pretty happy that he's done 3 years as a king, still alive. And he throws this banquet. And if you're going to show off, why not do it properly? So this banquet goes for 180 days. Right? That is half your year gone just banqueting. And if you're going to banquet for 180 days, then why not just extend it by another 7 days and just not invite your nobles and officials, but let's throw it open to all the men of the city, and your wife will put on a banquet for all the women as well. Now, on the 7th day of this banquet, let's call it the 187th day of an ongoing banquet, when the king, we're told, was in high spirits, we have different words in Australia for that, he was very drunk. Anyway, he's in high spirits, as you would be after drinking for 187 days consecutively. He orders that his queen, the Queen Vashti, who was at the time throwing her own banquet for the women, he asks that she be brought into his banquet to show off her beauty, for we're told that she was lovely to look at. And that's what he wanted everyone to do, to look at her. Well, Vashti has no intention of being ogled by a group of men who have been drinking for 187 consecutive days, nor of being treated like just another possession of the king. And so Vashti refuses to obey. The king is furious. He burns with anger at the humiliation his wife has now brought upon him. Now, this is such a national emergency that King Xerxes gathers his 7 wisest and most trusted nobles, and he asks them, "What must we do?" This is where my dad is laughing, right? And these 7 men, the wisest, the most noble in the whole empire, they grasp the seriousness of what has happened, the emergency that now threatens the very fabric of the Persian Empire. And so royal decrees are hastily issued to remove Vashti as queen and to ensure that across the entire Persian Empire that all women will respect, obey their husbands. Problem dealt with. Now, this is written with deliberate humor. It is ridiculing the king of Persia and his pretense of power. He may indeed be the most powerful man in the world, but the story portrays him as vain and as a complete buffoon. His wife won't do as he commands, and he can do nothing about it without the advice of 7 other supposedly wise men. And as we read on, we realize that such is the dopiness of the king of Persia that he also needs others to help him figure out how to find a new queen. And so he gathers officials, and they devise a plan for a queen to be found. And so from all over the empire, officials gather beautiful young women. That's the only criteria for being a queen back in those days. And in turn, these beautiful young women, and they would be young, are taken to the king for him to select his favourite. Now, does this seem like a reality TV show to you? I'm sure that's where they got the concept of The Bachelor from. Only one will receive the rose. And when Esther's turn comes to meet the king, she wins his favour. She receives the rose, and so she becomes queen. While all that is taking place, there's a side story that happens. Mordecai overhears a plot to kill the king, and he reports it to the authorities, and the conspirators are dealt with. And for his loyalty, Mordecai has his name recorded in the king's book, the history of the king. Now, in chapter 3 is where the villain now enters the story. Haman, is promoted to, I think I've got a photo of him, maybe. That was the marriage one, sorry. I missed that one. Does he look evil? Apparently there's a movie about this and a VeggieTales. So if you don't like my version, go watch VeggieTales. I shouldn't say that. Anyway, the villain now enters the story. Haman is promoted to the highest office in the king's court. And given the king's track record, we have no confidence that this will be a wise appointment. Haman is a descendant of the Amalekites, sworn enemies of the Jews since the time of Joshua. And the king has given orders that all should kneel before this man, all should kneel before Haman. But Mordecai would not. Haman's ego is so offended by this, he thinks to himself, I will not only have this man Mordecai killed, but I will have all of his race, all of the Jewish people in the empire destroyed. And so in the passage that was read to us by Kat, he comes to the king and he says, there are a people in our empire. It doesn't name that there are a people in our empire, their laws are different and they don't keep your laws, so it's inappropriate to tolerate them. Please issue a decree for their destruction and I will pay you, I think it said 10,000 talents, equivalent 375 tons of silver. Now the king, with an incompetence that we are now used to, asks no questions as to who these people might be. But he says, just do what seems good to you, all right? That's always, you just don't say that to anyone, do you? Just do whatever's good for you, right? Anyway, that's what the advice he gets. And so with the authority of the king, Xerxes, orders are issued for the destruction of all Jews, men, women, young and old, and the confiscation of their property on a set date being the 13th day of the 12th month in the Jewish calendar. And Esther, living in the palace, is unaware of all of this until word gets through to her from Mordecai, who begs her, do something. Do something. Approach the king for mercy for you and for our people. And she says, well, I can't. I can't just walk into his presence. And then Mordecai's words in chapter 4. Mordecai says to her, do not think that because you are in the king's house, that you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows, but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? And then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. After 3 days fasting, Esther enters, uncalled for, before King Xerxes. Fortunately, the king is pleased to see his wife and asks her request. Esther simply invites King and his most trusted and beloved advisor, Haman, to a cozy banquet for three. The king agrees and the three of them come together for a banquet, and the king is in such a good mood, he asks, what is your request? Half my kingdom, even that I will give you. Esther simply requests a second cozy banquet for three. Now, Haman is so happy. He can't believe that his life is so good. Can it get any better? Except then he goes outside and he sees Mordecai again, and Mordecai doesn't bow before him, and he's so angry and it wrecks his day, and he goes home to his wife and his family and they say, why don't you just hang the guy? He says, that's a great idea. So he has gallows built in his backyard and he's planning tomorrow. He says, tomorrow's going to be the best day in the world. I'm going to get up in the morning and I'm going to hang Mordecai from the gallows in my backyard. Like I said, not a kid's story, right? And then I'm going to go and have lunch with the king and with his wife. I'm going to have such a good day tomorrow. Little does he know. See, here's the coincidence, or one of the coincidences. That night, the king can't sleep. And what do you do when you can't sleep? What's the best cure for not sleeping? Read a history book. And if you're a king who is completely obsessed with himself, what kind of history would you most want to read? My own history. And so he does, he reads. And as he reads his own history, he reads how Mordecai saved his life And he calls out to his attendant, "What did we do to this man? What honour have we given him?" The attendant says, "Well, none that I can remember." And he goes, "Quick, find someone in the palace. I need some advice." And by coincidence, who's in the palace? Haman. And the humour in this is that we know what Haman doesn't. And this is in chapter 6. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honour?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honour than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honour, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is done. This is what is done for the man the king delights to honour.' Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended." Ah, don't you love it? So the morning hasn't gone according to plan, but there's still the banquet, right? Wrong. The cozy banquet for three, the king again asks, "What is your request, Esther?" And Esther says, "Would you grant me my life and spare the life of my people?" And the king is angry and he says, "Who would seek to harm you?" And I'm sure with drama, she goes, "This vile man." I'll make sure I pointed to no one, right? Yeah. "This vile man, Haman." The king storms out into the garden. Haman stays and he begs Esther for his life, for he knows that he is as good as dead now. But apparently he begs too keenly and too closely, for when the king returns, he accuses Haman of assaulting her. And there's an attendant nearby who helpfully chips in that Haman has built gallows to hang Mordecai on. And the king says, "That'll do. Hang him there." What a bad last day. And with both Esther and Mordecai so close to the king, after the events have taken place, after having his favour, there is little enthusiasm throughout the empire for carrying out Haman's plan. In fact, it is those who sought to destroy the Jews who are destroyed, and there is great celebration. This story makes no mention of God. It makes no mention of the law. It makes no mention of temple or sacrifices. It makes no mention of the things that meant so much to the Jews. And yet this is the power of the story of Esther. And this is the encouragement that comes from the story of Esther. That without all of those things, they were still the people of God. And the hand of God is everywhere in this story. We don't have long. I'm going to give you 2 minutes. I want you to talk to someone near you. What is it that comes out to you from this story about the nature of God, or a challenge or encouragement to us what it means to live as the people of God? We don't have long. 2 minutes. Go. All right. I did say I'd only give you a couple of minutes, I'm sorry, but that's okay. I'd love just if you're confident enough, what stood out to you from this story about the nature of God or our place in this world? What were the themes that come through? What was there anything? Just chuck a hand up so I can see where you are. Anything? Bev?
Men make their plans, but God has the final say.
Beautiful. Men make their plans, but God has the final say. It's a really strong theme that comes through. Good, good. What else? Anybody else have that one? Just... Oh, yours was unique. Kay, sorry. How? I missed that, and I do want to reply it for the live stream. How often God uses women? Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little subtle in the story, but Esther begins being described as a beautiful young woman, But the story reveals her to be a wise and a faithful and a courageous woman as well. So yeah, it's good. What else comes out from the story for you?
Every dog has its day.
Every dog has its day. Any others? Yeah, Mark.
Just back here, like, no matter what appearances are, God is at work behind the scenes.
Yeah. That's right. So whatever the appearance may look like, God is constantly at work behind the scenes. Yeah, no coincidences, are there? Yeah. All right. I'd just love to draw a couple of things together to finish. I think it's really important that when we hear a story, we don't just hear it as a story for back then, but we hear it as a story for us now. That this is a story that has been preserved for us as God's people as well, to learn from, to reflect on. And I think there are things that are really clear here. For me, the big one is faithfulness, that God is present in every situation, but he's not only present, but he's also faithful, and that he's placed us here for his purposes. It may be that, Esther didn't get to choose her life. She would have been a teenage woman when this happened. She didn't get to choose her life. And she may not have thought this was where God would have her, but Mordecai speaks that in. Perhaps this is why God has placed you here. Extraordinary courage. It's a story of remaining faithful and to remain faithful to God in every situation, every circumstance, because he will always be faithful to you. And as Mark said, those times where he feels absent, he is still there. He calls us to be a faithful presence. I think there are, for me, one of the other themes that comes through is this distinction between empire and kingdom. I really did miss a few pictures there, didn't I? Sorry to those on the live stream. We are called to be faithful believers and trustworthy citizens in our country, but always remaining faithful to God who has made us in Jesus Christ. That we are firstly and foremost citizens of heaven, not of a country and not of an empire. There are empires, but we do not belong to them. We belong to the kingdom that Jesus Christ established and that he will bring to fulfillment. And since the time of Let's go right back to the time of the Emperor Constantine. Christians have been tempted by what an empire can offer. What can empires offer? They can offer power and safety. They can offer land and wealth and influence and control. But we always have to remember that Jesus was born into an empire, but that he brought a kingdom. He did not establish a kingdom to oppose the Roman Empire, an empire that was strong and ruthless, but he established a kingdom that would turn it upside down. And just those words that we know so well in terms of this upside down kingdom, instead of an empire, he says these words, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are those whose life is pure, for they will see God. Blessed are those who are not fitted for war and seeking to dominate, but are peacemakers, for they are the children of God. Blessed are those who are insulted, persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And I missed one in there too, apologies. "Blessed are not the ruthless, but the what? The merciful, for they will receive mercy." Too often we've embraced empire, perhaps with good intentions, that somehow empire would help us promote the gospel. only to find that the price we pay is our faithfulness to Jesus Christ. Empires demand approval and blessing and compliance. But as Christians, we are firstly and foremost defined by our faith in and obedience to Christ. With no disrespect, we truly say that the only King we have is King Jesus. Let me pray. Father, we thank you for this story of Esther, for not only her story, but for the courage of Esther, but also of Mordecai, the way in which they were able to be a faithful presence in that country, in that empire. People who acted with love and compassion, who sought peace. People who trusted in you where you seemed absent. Father, may we be people of courage as well. People of faith. People who trust that in all situations you are present and that you are at work and that you place us where we are for your purposes. That we would be those who speak of and who demonstrate the values of your kingdom. May this be to your glory. In Christ's name, amen.